is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
In our system, we believe that every single person on the court, no matter who you are, has to be able to shoot the three, handle the basketball, be very versatile.
Bob Krasancik is the boys basketball head coach at Mentor High School in the state of Ohio. Bob has served as head coach at Mentor and Girard High School for a total of 39 years to date. He is one of four high school coaches in the state of Ohio to win state titles at different schools and receive five Hall of Fame awards as well. He currently has 679 career wins and ranks sixth in Ohio high school history. In the past three seasons, Bob has led the Cardinals to a record of 68-10. Bob is also the author of the new book, Mental Toughness, The Game Changer, How to Create Elite Athletes, Teams, and Athletic Programs. Hey, Hoopheads, I wanted to take a minute to shout out our partners and friends at Dr. Dish Basketball. Their Dr. Dish shooting machines are undoubtedly the most advanced and user-friendly machines on the market. Learn more at drdishbasketball.com and follow their incredible content at Dr. Dish B-Ball on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Mention the Hoopheads podcast and save an extra $300 on the Dr. Dish Rebel, All-Star, and CT models. Visit drdishbasketball.com for details. That's a great deal, Hoopheads. Get your Dr. Dish shooting machine today.
Hi, this is Coach Corey Harris from the Beijing Royal Fighters CBA team, and you're listening to the Hoopheads podcast. Let's get into it.
Prepare like the pros with the all-new Fast Draw and Fast Scout. Fast Draw has been the number one play diagramming software for coaches for years. You'll quickly see why Fast Model Sports has the most compelling and intuitive basketball software out there. For a limited time, Fast Model is offering Hoopheads listeners 15% off Fast Draw and Fast Scout. Just use the code HHP15 at checkout to grab your discount, and you'll be on your way to more efficient game prep and improve communication with your team. Fast Model also has new coaching content every week on its blog, plus play and drill diagrams on its playbank. Check out the links in the show notes for more. Fast Model Sports is the best in basketball. If you're looking to improve your coaching, please consider joining the Hoopheads Mentorship Program. We believe that having a mentor is the best way to maximize your potential and become a transformational coach. By matching you up with one of our experienced mentors, you'll develop a one-on-one relationship that will help your coaching, your team, your program, and your mindset. The Hoopheads Mentorship Program delivers mentoring services to basketball coaches at all levels through our team of experienced head coaches. Find out more at hoopheadspod.com or shoot me an email directly, mike@hoopheadspod.com. Follow us on social media at hoopheadspod on Twitter and Instagram, and be sure to check out the Hoopheads Podcast Network for more great basketball content. Coach, do you struggle with building a championship culture, getting your players to communicate on the court, maximizing your practice time, and bringing out the best in all your players? We all struggle in at least a few of these areas, and that's why over 1,500 coaches a year from all levels of play attend a summer or fall PGC course to learn these things. And coaches consistently say spending a week at PGC is the most useful and beneficial investment they've ever made in their coaching career. At your PGC course, you'll attend all the classroom, video, and court sessions, just like the players. If you're ready to take your coaching and your team to new heights next season, go to pgcbasketball.com, find a summer or fall course near you, and sign up. That's pgcbasketball.com. Get ready to take some notes as you listen to this episode with Bob Krasancik, boys basketball head coach at Mentor High School in Cleveland, Ohio. Hello and welcome to the Hoopheads podcast. It's Mike Linsing here this morning without my co-host Jason Sunkel, but I am pleased to be joined by the head boys basketball coach at Mentor High School here in Cleveland, Ohio, Bob Krasancik. Bob is also the author of a brand new book entitled Mental Toughness, The Game Changer, How to Create Elite Athletes, Teams, and Athletic Programs. So let's start there, Bob. Just give us the quick synopsis of what the book's all about, why you decided to write it, and then we'll dive more into your career and what you've been able to do in the game of basketball.
The book is definitely not a basketball playbook. When we sent it to publishers, that's why I think they picked it up so quick. It's more about life, the mentality that goes into a job, especially coaching or an athlete. But in 2009, I met one of my players' moms. Her two sons graduated in 2007 and 9, Kathy Lombardo. We were sitting at a graduation party, and she said, "Coach, would you like to write a book?" And it piqued my interest. So for the next 10 years, I would see Kathy periodically, especially in summers, at graduation parties and events in Mentor. And every year she said, "Coach, you ready to write a book?" And in 2019, I kind of paused and I said, "You know, Kath, let's do it." So we got together in August, and in 9 months, we put together a book, sent it. I do remember hearing a story. Dr. Seuss sent 29 of his manuscripts to publishers, and on the 30th one, he finally got it published. So I wasn't expecting, you know, people to jump on it. But to our surprise, in 5 days, Newman Springs, it's a, you know, pretty solid publisher. They have Ingram as their major outlet, and then Amazon, Barnes & Nobles, and Apple iTunes. And they said, "We'll take it." So we signed the contract. And then for the next almost 2 years, we went through revisions and edits. But I think we got it right. And I'm glad we got the COVID season in and this past season in, because I think it added to the book. But the book's about, or I believe, a blueprint for parents, athletes, coaches. I've had the opportunity to speak with businesses about team bonding, the mentality of a unit. So I think it's a wide range. I've had some people in their 80s that have read the book that had some illnesses that said that they read the book, and that they're ready to, you know, attack the illnesses and to keep living. And, you know, that is part of the book. Never stop dreaming. You know, you could dream at 85. You know, one of my favorite things is when you stop dreaming, you stop growing. And I really believe that. So the book is, I didn't want anybody to read it cover to cover, and they could, but for, let's say, a coach or an athlete to go to a certain section that could help them on it, you know, dealing with parents, dealing with your youth programs, dealing with social media, how to get your kids started. When my two sons came up, I called Drew Joyce and said, "You've coached your two sons, Drew and Cam. You know, give me some advice. Tell me, you know, what you did right and what you would do different." And Drew was great. And, you know, it's not easy to coach your kids, especially in high school and even possibly college, like Jim Boeheim. But there's a section of, you know, coaching your son. And my two sons put little pieces in there that I thought were unbelievable. So I hope that gave you a little synopsis, and then hit me with questions.
Let's start out with that coaching your son piece, because that's something that I think there are a lot of coaches out there that, even if they don't do it at the high school or the college level, there are so many people that are coaching their kids at the lower levels, whether that just be their first experience in a rec program or eventually they get into travel basketball or AAU. And I know I've been in that position. And as you go through and you're trying to navigate that and figure it out, and what's it look like? So what's some of the advice that Drew Joyce gave to you, or then what's some advice that after you went through it that you'd give to somebody out there who's coaching their own kid?
First of all, I had the opportunity to be on the Josh and Maria Cribb show on Wednesday. And Maria asked me about that exact question, because she said, "Our kid's in seventh grade and they're coming up." And she said, "How was it?" So I'll go at the end first. And I said, it was 98% absolutely great. And there were 2% of the things that, you know, were kind of frustrating, which you can imagine. But what we had is parameters, rules. And we said that basketball was fair game, you know, at the gym, in the car, outside the house. But in the house, we weren't going to talk about basketball. And that was one thing that Drew and a couple other head coaches had told me. And I think that really, really worked well. So that was like a safe haven. You know, it was family time, and, you know, relax, you know, go do your video, go do your homework, whatever. But we had those rules, and those were pretty strict. The one major advantage that I saw that I didn't know was that when my sons were in first grade, second, third, I would throw them in the van with the players and the bus, and they would bring their friends. And, you know, Cole's best friend was Jaron Crow, and those two were great teammates. Jaron was a great player in college. We went to state with them. Connor grew up with Brandon Fritz, Mitch Trubisky, same thing. We throw him in a car. We go to Buffalo with my family to see them. They'd be on the bus in fifth grade, sixth grade. They, you know, go to the summer camps. We had a rule that on our varsity, well, my young kids, my sons were growing up, and they're like in third, fourth, fifth grade, that whoever played the worst, we would vote at the end of the day, like at a shootout at Ohio State, and the three young ones had to stay in their room. So it was almost hilarious that they didn't want to get voted worst because they'd have to have the three young ones stay with them. But it was a really, really good experience. I think transparency is huge. You know, I told my son, I said, Cole, he was the oldest. I said, when you we play away, be ready. And when freshman year, he would get to the foul line and they'd be chanting daddy's boy and just some of the chants. And he actually got to enjoy it by his junior and senior year. But his freshman year, I thought he was going to cry a few times when he went to the foul line. But again, I wouldn't trade it for the world. You get to spend the time in the gym, at games. You know, the toughest loss of my life was the Cincinnati Molar game in the state semis and overtime with Cole. And then the best, I've won a couple state championships, but in 2013 with my son Connor on the court and Cole right behind the bench in the stands with Justin Fritz and a couple people, that was probably the best victory of my life.
Was it easy or hard to navigate that rule of only talking basketball outside of the house? Did you quickly adjust to that once you set it up as the parameters, or was it still a case where there were times where you're in the house and you're like, I really want to talk some basketball with these guys?
Oh, it's much tougher on me. I would be talking to an assistant or whatever, and then I would want to go up in their bedroom and say, hey, we got to do this, 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 and this. It was really, really tough. You know, one of the they were both named captains on the basketball team, but my youngest son played football, and him and Mitch were great friends, and they still are today. In fact, Connor just moved from L.A. to Florida within a half hour of Mitch because Mitch lives in Boca. But Connor was quarterback the year when Mitch left for North Carolina, and I could hear him, you know, like up by 3-4 in the morning, and this was in the summer. And I said, Connor, what's wrong with you? You know, you're not sleeping. I hear you up. And he said, Dad, when I was a wideout and I was on a football team and I was captain as a junior, he said, I didn't have responsibility like Mitch did. And he said, now I feel responsible for 110 guys since I'm the quarterback and I'm captain. And I was so impressed that he felt responsible and just wanted to help and motivate every single person on his team. And that was, we tried not, even football, we did not talk a lot of football in the house when he played. And they went to the state semis and they lost to Molar in the championship his senior year. But again, we had those rules, and my sons loved it because they couldn't wait to get in the house sometimes and out of the car. But it was tough on me, but I got used to it.
All right, let's go back in time to when you were a kid. Tell me a little bit about how you got into the game of basketball when you were younger. And then as you work through sort of your time as a player, when did coaching get on your radar? So just talk about some of your early experiences with basketball and then how coaching became such an important part of your life.
You know, I knew that early I loved basketball. I'd be one of those that would shoot till 11, 12 at night, shovel the driveway, couldn't wait to get on the court. My father was a recreation director part-time, so he would be responsible for the gyms and the fields in Girard. So that was an advantage for me. And he was a minor league baseball player, so I grew up in an athletic background. You know, he loved sports, so that was a huge advantage. But in high school, I played baseball and basketball, and I kind of knew that basketball was the ticket because it was easier to get a scholarship. And I probably wasn't going to – I was going to commute to a school versus if I got a scholarship. So I put a ton of time into basketball. I played baseball in the summers. And I played a baseball game in a different city. And I went to Girard High School. And after the game, my head basketball coach – was standing there waiting for me. And I was 15, a sophomore going into my junior year. And he had a basketball. And he said, can I give you a ride home? And I said, sure. I was going to go with one of my buddies. So Coach Bauer took me to the gym. He held up the basketball. And in those days, the basketball probably cost about $30-32. He said, this could make your life and pay for your college education. And that was just one of those ah moments in your life that it just really hit me. So from there, I did spend a lot of time in basketball. I got a full ride to YSU. We were going; they were D2, going D1, so that was exciting. We start to play West Virginia, Cincinnati, Ohio State, and us at Akron. Went into the OVC, which was a great conference. And my sophomore year, in between Christmas and New Year's, the University of San Francisco was playing like 3-4 Eastern teams. So we played them, and I started, and they scored. I probably got the basketball with about 19 minutes and 50 seconds, and this one guard, probably 5'8", 5'9", was in my face. And they rotated two guards that were the quickest, toughest people, and it was the most miserable basketball game I've ever played in my life. And afterwards, I said, if I ever have an opportunity to coach, that I would want to make life as miserable for the opponent as those two made me. And it's in the book. And that's, it has a huge, I believe it's a huge reason why we press, we run. You know, I believe that, you know, you've got to put the pressure on 24/7 or 32 straight minutes in a high school basketball game. And that's been a big part of my philosophy. Early, I would, you know, got the job when I was 25 years old. I probably was too young, but I would go to the Nike clinics and I'd, you know, Valvano and George Raveling and all the great coaches. And I took little bits and pieces of presses and breaks. And again, that's in the book about, you know, have your identity, your philosophy, your culture, and don't change it. But tweak it, take little pieces of other successful coaches and implement it in your program. And I think that's the key of being a really, really good coach. You're going to steal pieces from everybody, but how you fit it into what you believe in is the key to success.
When you go and you start looking at the opportunity that you had, you mentioned as a young coach at age 25 to become a head coach, and you think back to that time, what's something that you were really good at, confident with when it came to coaching? Because obviously there's a lot to learn when you get a job at 25, and especially coming off a successful playing career. I think we all have an ego of, hey, I know a lot about the game of basketball, and suddenly you step into that coaching role and you're like, maybe I don't know quite as much as I thought I did. But what was something that you took to right away that just felt natural, felt right for you as a coach?
I was worried about hiring a staff, and the superintendent was young, and it was carte blanche. I had the freedom to hire who I wanted, and he just said, make sure you hire the right people. And I would tell any coach, don't worry about what a young coach knows. Hire on loyalty, energy, and passion. And if you have a young coach, and we've done that in the last couple of years at Mentor, I wanted some young blood, some energy in the gym. And I love my staff. But I believe that if, you know, they want to be in the gym and they have that passion and energy, they're going to learn. And your system has to be synonymous all the way through, even the feeder program. You know, our seventh and eighth grade, our ninth grade, our JV. And I had the luxury and, you know, the ability to go down and speak to our third, fourth, fifth, and sixth grade programs at both Girard and at Mentor. I actually set up my senior year of college. I set up the first feeder program in the city of Girard for fourth, fifth, and sixth grade. And 5 years later, when I got the job, those young men were seventh, eighth, and ninth, and 10th grade. And it was unbelievable, the timing. You know, I believe timing is everything and God works in strange ways. But That was a huge part of the success at Girard. You know, the feeder program that started when I was my senior year at YSU, and I established the rules and all the ramifications of practices and schedules and how you play the game, you know, all man-to-man. Every offense has to be where five people touch the ball and five people move. And I got that from other really good head coaches. As a first-year coach, you know, go in with, you better have the most energy. When you walk in the gym, you know, things better change. And they better change as far as effort, energy, mentality. And those are just simple things, and they're easier said than done. But if you could do those, I believe you're off to a great start.
Do you think that you kind of came to that, I don't want to say naturally, as if you didn't work at it, but do you think that that's something that you brought to the table sort of intuitively with your background, going through and thinking about your experiences with your dad, and then obviously you as a player getting to be a college player and just the experience that you had there? Do you think you came into it with sort of maybe intuitively knowing that, hey, these are the things that I've got to do?
I thought I did. And I knew what I wanted to do. But the first year, and this is another thing, I got some unbelievable advice from a coach from Pennsylvania that had won 7 state titles, Coach McCluskey. And I said, Coach, can you give me just one little nugget, one piece? And he said, eliminate idiots. And I kind of knew what he meant. Or eliminate people that aren't in the same mentality and you know, don't want to do what you want to do. So my very first year, I cut 10 out of 12 seniors, and I threw a junior off that was all league because he just didn't want to bust his butt. And the town had a paper, the Girard News, and they just ripped me. My very second day, I got hired on a Tuesday by the Board of Education. And it was a nice little celebration. And the next two nights, I met a couple of my buddies that wanted to start a booster club. I thought that was a huge part. You need a great booster club. And by day four of when I was hired, the word was Coach K is drinking his dinners. So, you know, I learned so fast. You know, I wanted to start a booster club. I wanted to have the people on the court. And I did what, you know, kind of people told me to do. But I don't want to say it backfired, but I learned really, really quick. You know, stick to your guns and be very careful what you do on the outside. First year, we win one game. I had a 2-year contract, thank God. The second year, we were 1-5. And I'm doubting myself. Think about it. I'm 2-25 in my career. And I'm just saying, oh, man. And we went on a 7-game winning streak, beat 2 top 10 teams in a state. And that really had never happened at Girard. And then we were off. The one thing that I will give myself some kudos, I stuck to my guns and I didn't change what we believed in. And we just dug in and worked. I mean, we actually went to probably 2 days on Saturdays and Sundays. And the town bought in, the parents bought in, the players bought in. I had 2 booster clubs. And in year 13 at Girard, we won the state. We had beat a couple number one teams in the state. We had gone to regionals a number of times. So we were almost known as one of the better D2 teams in the state of Ohio. In the year we won it in 2000 or 1993, 221 was a cutoff for Division II. If you had 220 boys and you were Division III, 221, you were Division II. Girard that year, we had 221. So we actually won the state.
You couldn't get anybody to move?
Well, we didn't know. And it was afterwards. I would have. You know, we would have done something. But I was stunned because I thought we had a good chance of being D3. And St. Joe's had won the state in D1 in 91, in D2 in 92, and like had 5 D1 players that were just London Fletcher that went on to play NFL 15 years, Hosevar going to UNLV, they had just won a national championship, Ricardo Crumble going to DePaul University, Kwasniak, his son, who played at Army, had a great career there. I mean, just absolutely loaded players. Melvin Levitt went to Cincinnati and was drafted number 2 in the NBA. We beat them in the regional finals. So, to answer your question, again, if you're a coach, you know, This is a great story. And if I'm going off the thing, you know, you tell me. But a couple
stories are great.
I met Josh Gordon in Florida, and he was just left the Browns in New England and picked him up. And a phenomenal young man, truthfully. I was really impressed. So we were talking. He called me coach, and which I said, Josh, call me Bob. You know, you're an NFL player. He said, no. He said, coach. So we're just talking about, you know, philosophies a little bit. And he said, quick into the conversation, he said, I got signed by New England. And he said, when I walked into their compound, he said, within 5 minutes, I knew exactly who they were, what their culture was, and what their identity was. So I was so impressed with that. And I went back to Mentor, and I met with our staff and our team. And I said, if somebody comes to our practice, somebody comes to our game, even in warmups, within a few minutes, I want them to know who we are, you know, what the identity of Mentor basketball is. You know, we press, we run, you know, we try to when we have a player in our program, the first thing we talk about is being elite. But elite in athletically, academically, ethically, morally. So when you graduate as a basketball player and you leave our program, you know, you're ready to attack the world. But a great, great, probably 30-minute talk with Josh Gordon.
That's really cool that you get an opportunity to have that discussion. And sometimes it's amazing that I'm sure you didn't go into that conversation thinking that you were going to pull out that particular piece of wisdom and then go back and try to evaluate your own program under that standard. So to be able to get that from a conversation, I think that's one of the things that we've been able to enjoy as part of the podcast is you're having these conversations with coaches, and there's so many different things that a coach will say or that will bring or that they do in their program that's maybe unique. And hopefully the people that are out there in the audience end up doing exactly what you did, which is they hear somebody talking, they say, wow, that's something that I could take back immediately and implement into my program. And those are really the things that we're trying to do every day when we do these episodes, is just get information out there to coaches that they can use and really put to use in their program. So when you think back to that, those first couple of years at Girard, was it easier or harder, you think, because of the fact that you went to school there? Do you think that made the job easier or harder on you looking back retrospectively?
I think at the beginning it didn't matter. And then as in my fifth, sixth, seventh year, when some of the people I went to school with, some of the people I know, and now their sons are playing in the program. And that I saw, I don't want this to sound strange, but after 13 years and a lot of my classmates that still remained in Girard, and their sons now were starting to be sophomores, juniors, and coming up at the high school level, I think it was a good time to leave because that does present some problems. But while I was there, there are advantages. You know people. I could, you know, I started two booster programs. The people knew my background. There was transparency. They knew I'd played high school basketball there, college basketball at YSU. So again, I would say, like coaching your sons, 90 to 95%. Really, really good coaching in your hometown. But there were some of those drawbacks. I'm going to go back into the previous question real quick, because I think in life, when you talk about Josh Gordon, Jim Tressel was coach at YSU football. And I had got to met him. I met him through some mutual friends. And after games, we would go to the MBR and, you know, talk and play bocce. And he wrote an endorsement on the back of the book. Very, very thankful. Just a great person. But Coach Tressel, one of his football philosophies was he did not want to turn the ball over. He felt that he would win 95% of the football games if they had less turnovers the opponent. And that was something that stuck in my mind. And I would go to basketball practices and just say, we cannot turn the ball over. We have to win the turnover battle. And in a lot of games, I'd put 5-3 ratio. You know, if they get 20, you know, we can 12 or less. And then in some games be 5-2, you know, if I thought so. But I'd always put that ratio, and we have to win the turnover battle. And I think when the smaller we got at Mentor, the more we ran, we would get 90 possessions a game, which is huge for a high school team. And we averaged like 5 years in a row, less than 10 turnovers a game. And when you're playing our style, you really have to coach more in practice and you let them go in the game, because in running press, you're not calling plays, you're not calling set plays, and you really have to trust your players. And that's one thing that a lot of coaches that have tried our system, they like the control a little bit more and they're used to it. So I didn't mean to go back in a question. I think I answered the hometown question, and let's go to the next one.
Your first impression is everything when applying for a new coaching job. A professional coaching portfolio is the tool that highlights your coaching achievements and philosophies, and most of all, helps separate you and your abilities from the other applicants. The Coaching Portfolio Guide is an instructional membership-based website that helps you develop a personalized portfolio. Each section of the Portfolio Guide provides detailed instructions on how to organize your portfolio in a professional manner. The guide also provides sample documents for each section of your portfolio that you can copy, modify, and add to your personal portfolio. As a Hoopheads Pod listener, you can get your Coaching Portfolio Guide for just $25. Visit coachingportfolioguide.com/hoopheads to learn more.
All right, so I want to build on the system that you run and that you play in Mentor. Let's start out by, before we talk about how you implement that as a coach at the high school level, let's go back to your experience building a youth program. Because I think one of the things, when I look around at what makes a high school coach successful, and anybody can have one season or two seasons where you get a good group of talent coming through in a particular class. But when you talk about a program year in and year out that you know that they're going to be good because they've had players that come up through their youth program that have learned their style of play, that have learned their terminology. Just tell us a little bit about how you have it set up today in terms of how do you go through and teach your coaches at the middle school level your system? How do you go down to the youth level and make sure that when those kids are playing travel basketball, that they're getting the things that they're going to need to eventually become a part of your high school program? And then just talk about the visibility where those kids and those families get to know you, so that there's an aspirational aspect of them looking when they're in fifth, sixth grade and saying, man, I can't wait one day to be able to suit up and put on a Mentor uniform and run out and go through layup lines and be a part of the program. So just kind of run us through how you take your style of play and the things that you do on the varsity level and implement them at the lower levels.
Well, next week, Monday through Friday, we'll run a camp, grades 3 to 6. We'll probably get 90 to 95 players. We'll run two camps in the afternoon, grades 1 and 2, probably get 50 in the 1 and 2 and 40 to 50 in the older group. And, you know, we talk about our philosophy, and the parents come in, and it's a great time to meet with the parents of the younger kids and talk our philosophy and what we believe in. And the people that run the youth programs will come in and talk probably 5 minutes and give out forms for the programs. And a lot of our middle school coaches will be coaching the camps, so they get a firsthand look at the kids coming in 7th, 8th, and 9th. So those are advantages right there. A lot of parents will call me and say, what would you recommend for my kid in 1st, 2nd, 3rd, 4th? He loves basketball. My best advice, and again, it's in the book, is youth coming up. Always play up. If your son or daughter is pretty good, always have them play up. When my sons were 1st grade, 2nd grade, I had them play either 1 year or 2 year up against bigger, better, stronger players. That is the quickest way. You know, you could spend $50 on an hour on people that skill work and all that. And that's not bad. I don't want to degrade that. But the quickest way is playing against somebody that is bigger, better, and stronger than you. When I set up the youth program at Girard, it was, again, all man-to-man. I sent down the drills. The recreation department paid me to come in a couple nights in September and October before our season started at YSU, and just trying to, you know, give them a good idea of how to run the drills. Offensively, 5-man weave, open post, that five people are moving, cutting, backdoor. You know, you're learning the basic fundamentals of the game. Pre-game, you know, how to get your players, your team loose, and how to have them be fundamentally sound in passing the basketball, cutting, you know, getting the three-point shot now. And then in seventh and eighth grade, we you know, talk to the coaches a lot. We'll have some of our varsity players possibly go down and work with the seventh or eighth grade team. I tell all the players in the seventh and eighth grade, if you want to ride the bus to an away game, if you want to come in our locker room at a home game, you know, two to three at a time, get a good idea of what it's like to be a better basketball player. So you try to make as many situations relevant where they're not awestruck, or it's not a crazy situation when they're coming as a freshman, or especially as a sophomore, junior. We, in the summer, you know, when you're going from eighth to ninth grade, we have our freshmen play in JV or low varsity leagues. Our JVs play in low varsity leagues, or if they're really good, play in against really good varsity competition. So again, we're always playing up and trying to play against better competition. Our varsity team, when we go to a shootout, we're not going to go unless we get great competition. We're playing in a league with Pick Central, Akron St. V's, all the good schools in Cleveland. You know, we try to travel. We've gone to Tom Izzo's camp. We've gone to Huggins camp in West Virginia. And before we go, I say, hey, get us the best games possible, you know, in June, so that, you know, we're ready to go in December and January.
What's your philosophy on scheduling? So I know that coaches, depending upon where you're at in your career and the type of talent that you have, I was always kind of the mentality that prepare your team for the tournament and schedule tougher games. And clearly, depending upon where you are, maybe if you're a new coach and you just need to get some wins under your belt to be able to keep your job, you know, that can be something. But just when hearing you talk about trying to make sure that your players get the best opportunity to improve and get better, how does that translate into the way that you schedule during the regular season, preparing your team for state tournament play?
You made a great point. You know, there are some coaches that need the W's, and that's a tough, you know, market right there. I always believed in playing better competition, and I'd say probably 98-97% of the teams are in a league, so you have no choice in those 10-12-14 league games, but you do in the independent games. And that's where I think that we really try to play the best competition. A few years ago, Mike and I said, let's be one of the best teams in the state. You know, let's shoot for a state title, because I thought I dreamed small. And I, you know, still ticked at myself for not believing in the biggest, you know, thing that we could do. So when we start competing and doing really well against the best teams in the state, I said, hey, let's try to be one of the best teams in the country. And with all the prep schools and that, it's hard to do. But our players started to believe that. In 2003, we played Akron St. V's. They were number one in the country. They had LeBron James. In 2013, we played Huntington Prep with Andrew Wiggins, and he was the number one player in the country. They were number four because they lost a game without him. But we played them at Walsh University in the Dunk for Diabetes, and we played them in the last game. It was packed. It was a great atmosphere. And we have the basketball with 4.4 seconds to go, down one on an OB. So we had a chance to beat the number four team in the country. We look to go to a Christmas tournament that, again, has some of the best teams in the country. We've been invited to the Arby's Classic seven times. We, in pre-COVID year, we played back-to-back the number 21 and number 39 teams in the country. This year, we didn't go there, but they had the number four and number nine teams in the country. So we look to go to a Christmas tournament. We've been to San Diego, Phoenix, Utah, West Virginia a number of times, Pennsylvania, Michigan. So we do look to play those Christmas tournaments and possible shootouts against, you know, a team that is going to be a state title contender and possibly one of the best in the country. I think we're about to schedule a game against St. Ignatius next year at the Q or with Rocket Mortgage Arena. And I think the back-to-back games is Sierra Canyon and St. V's and us and St. Ignatius. And I think if we could, you know, sign the contract, that will be, a great game. And those type of atmospheres, Arby's Classic, you see it's 7,000 a game. And in 2013, we played Huntington Prep and we played in the championship of the Arby's Classic. They had this back-to-back 7,000-seat game. So when we go down to the Shot and they have, 12, 14,000, we played in front of that types of crowds before and that types of competition. So that's, I really believe, every time that we've come back from a Christmas tournament that was loaded or a great showcase, I thought we were a better basketball team.
To me, that makes so much sense to put your kids in a position where they can play against better competition. And I think you talked about it a little bit earlier when you were discussing just how you improved as a player and getting an opportunity to work against better players, older players. And the system that we have today in youth basketball growing up is far different than the one that you and I grew up in. When you think about just playing pickup basketball or playing in the neighborhood, and kids today are playing AAU and doing all those things. But AAU has become a big part of players' development. So as a high school coach, what's your philosophy in terms of working with AAU, trying to help your players to maximize the opportunity that they get from summer basketball? How have you handled sort of that transition from what it was like back when you first started coaching, where that system pretty much didn't exist, to kind of what we have today? How have you navigated that to make sure that your players are getting the best out of that system?
And that's a great, great question, especially in this day and age, because you need AAU for exposure. And we recognize that. I hate to say it, but I look at AAU as a necessary evil. We try to tell our players, especially from a young age, 7th, 8th, and 9th, try to get on an AAU team that has a similar philosophy to us, that's going to play man-to-man, that's, going to run and press, that's going to let you, or you're going to be able to handle the basketball. In our system, we believe that every single person on the court, no matter who you are, has to be a great ball handler. Micah Potter is, with the Miami Heat, and at 6'10", we made Micah handle the basketball and shoot the three. And that's been a huge advantage at Ohio State and Wisconsin. Adam May was 6'8", played at Holy Cross, great career, handled the basketball. So every person in our system, has to be able to, again, shoot the three, handle the basketball, be very versatile. In AAU, try to get on a team, if at all possible, where you're going to be able to do those things that's going to make you a better basketball player for us. It's not always happens. And, right now AAU is, I hear players are playing on a different team from week to week and that. But the AAU coaches that have had our players have been very impressed with their basketball IQ, with their effort, with their team play. So I'm very pleased with that. And then we go on to college. A lot of the college coaches have talked about our players' high, basketball IQ, great effort, in practice, in the game. So those are great things, that make me feel good about our staff and about what we do.
Talk a little bit about your role as a high school coach in helping your players to get to the next level, how you build relationships with college coaches, and then just what are the steps that you take as a high school coach to ensure that your players are getting an opportunity to play at the next level if that's what they want to do?
We tell our players immediately that, you cannot have weaknesses. You've got to be able to shoot the three. You've got to be able to handle the basketball. College coaches will immediately ask me if let's say you're a two on offense, you're 6'1", 6'2". Can they guard 6'4", 6'5"? Can they guard a quick 5'8", 5'9" guard? Said, you have to be versatile defensively. We had many years where we had almost 6'2 and under and three guards around 5'11". And if another team is like 6'5", 6'5", 6'7", one of our guards is going to guard somebody that is a huge disadvantage. You've got to have a high basketball IQ. We want to limit dribbles. We want to get the ball up the court as quick as possible. Our players have learned that Micah Potter and Adam May, being able to run the floor, pressing, running, has helped them at the college level. So this was a great stat from 2008 to 2014. Every one of our players except one, and that was Mike Johannik, and he was a really good athlete, but he went straight to pharmacy school and got his pharmaceutical degree. He was the only one in that seven-year period that if you started for Mentor, you played at the next level. Now, that's not all basketball players. That's Trubisky in football. It's my son Connor going to Minnesota. Cade McClure and Caleb Potter going to Louisville in West Virginia for basketball. But you are going to be an athlete. So we talk about if you start for Mentor, you have a great chance of playing at the next level. Take our 2019 starting lineup. Mason Trubisky played at John Carroll Basketball. Chad Rogers pitching for Penn State. Luke Floria, YSU. Luke Chacone, YSU. Luke Floria, football, Kent State. And that's been, pretty strong throughout every one of our years and every one of our, groups of players. If you start at Mentor, you're going to have a great shot of playing at the next level. And college coaches know that. We don't put a lot of D1s in basketball, but, we'll put a lot at D2, a lot at D3, and they do a great job, at that level.
How do you've mentioned a couple of times basketball IQ. So when you think about that as a basketball coach and you're designing your practices, and obviously you also, your style of play where you're not running a bunch of set plays, you're pressing, you're going up and down the floor, you're shooting a lot of threes, you have this free-flowing style of play, which, as you said, as a coach, your work's done in practice as opposed to having that control of walk it up, call a set. You're giving the players much more control. So in order to do that, you have to have players who have a high basketball IQ, who understand what it is that you're trying to get done with them out on the floor. So when you think about that from a practice design, what are some things that you feel like you and your program do well helping your players to develop their IQ in a practice setting?
We learned a long time ago that in our style, we could use a 10-second shot clock. I really believe that. That's what we constantly put 7 seconds on the clock. And as soon as if we're pressing, our managers are at the clock. And as soon as we get the basketball on a steal or rebound, we have 7 seconds to get a good shot off. Not a shot, a good shot, a high percentage. So our players are constantly, almost everything that we run offensively is, by the shot clock. If we're running an offense, we'll put 4 seconds in a half court setting. We have to attack really quick. And, you've got to be able to create in a very short amount of time. And in that, we learned that offensively, if we pick at about 25, 30 feet, especially with our big men, and this is what we really try to do. We try to get mismatches so quick. And our players, you talk about basketball IQ. As soon as we, execute the pick, and it's not really a pick and roll, it's a pick to set our point guard free. And we learned it is so hard. If a big man is guarding one of our bigger guys, it is so tough to hedge and to stop our point guard in transition. So that is one of the keys to what we want to do and how we want to attack is get that pick in transition. And then we have a point guard such as Florey or Chacon that were both first team and second team all states. And, we have some really good players that can do stuff with the basketball. If they're attacking in the open court and they're not guarded by a good defensive guard, I think that is one of the reasons that we're successful. We talk about basketball IQ. If you're a guard and you have the basketball and we have two guys that are open and one's like a 40 to 45%, really good 3-point shooter and one's, let's say, a 30 to 35, you better know who you get the basketball to. It's the higher percentage shooter. That's going to work for us. So again, when you're going, blowing the ball up the floor and you have two people open, you better know who to pass to. It's not a, of 50-50. It is like an 80, 85, 90 percentage that you better know who to get the basketball. If we run it, let's say a pick, big and a guard, and that big man's open really quick, you better get him the basketball, not kick it back out, because we've got a major mismatch quick. We talk about it in our press situation. If a really good shooter is down the floor, well, you can't cheat as much as you normally could, because we don't want to let him have a great three-point shot. And we'll adjust our presses if shooters are down the floor, or if they have two great shooters and now they're 90 feet, 80 feet from the bucket, we trap them and make them give the basketball up. We give up a lot of great shots sometimes in our press. But if it's a shot that it's somebody that's shooting 25 to 30% from threes or isn't really great at finishing, that's okay. So those are little things that our players learn in practice. You know, we don't watch a lot of film, but we'll watch a little film and just say, hey, here's who we do not want to get the ball to or get open. Here's who we want to have the basketball, especially in trapping situation. So our players, you know, in this day and age, huddle, you know, they can make their own highlight films. They could watch. If we play Medina, they'll probably have 5 to 7 Medina films, and we'll say, hey, go to this one, watch this one. We played them last year, watch this one when we played them earlier the year, and you better understand what they do offensively, defensively. And when we go in a game, we better be so much smarter than the other team.
Talk about a change in technology from when you started coaching to what we can do now. When you think back to the era of VCRs and videotapes, and I just remember hitting that button or watching a coach hit the button when I was a player and have it spiral back a minute and a half past the play that the coach actually wanted to watch or that you wanted to watch as a player. And now you think about what we can do with huddle and just the ability that coaches and players have to be able to watch film. It's just, that's one of the, probably one of the most incredible changes, I think, from a coaching standpoint, is just to be able to have all that access, and not just to your own film, but you can, how easy it is to exchange and just do all of those things. When you're talking about trying to teach some of the concepts that you talked about finding open shooters and using that high screen and being able to set up and get your point guard going downhill, are you teaching that out of 5-on-5 settings in practice? Are you doing breakdown, small-sided games type work? Just how do you break that down as you're trying to get your kids to understand those particular skills and what you're looking for?
You know, we believe in throwing them into the fire. Found the quickest way. We've had a couple really good freshmen, and we'll just throw them in our press, and they'll learn by making mistakes. And, you know, it's okay to fail in the summer and before the season. It's during the season that you better understand, you know, and learn from your mistakes. And we'll tell them, hey, go back and watch films of this player, watch films of this team, the position, you know, the wing, you know, if you're back on a press, if you're on the ball. And they did it probably better than anybody that we've had. So just watch what they do. Effort takes care of, makes up for a lot of mistakes also. One of the best things opposing coaches have said to, you know, myself and our staff is, you play through mistakes better than anybody I've seen. And that's huge. You know, you can't, you know, mope for a quarter of a second, a half a second. So that's a great teaching point when you talk about even basketball IQ, mentality. But technology is amazing. When we go into halftime, you know, we have a couple coaches that, you know, talk about threes, you know, their percentage on the other team, who has them, you know, the five guys that were on the floor that, you know, did the best unit against this team. So technology is just absolutely amazing. I could go finish a game and we'll be talking to our team, and I'll go to our assistants. You know, tomorrow, let's look at our defensive OBs because we gave up too many great looks. Let's look at our OBs because we didn't score enough. And, you know, boom, we'll get the 12 to 14 right in a row. You know, I said, let's look our press breakers against their 100 or their 25 and let's see what we could have done better. And the breakdown's amazing. At YSU, I was assistant coach at the Youngstown Pride, and we use their facilities. And after a football game, I was talking to their tech guy, and this was back in the early 90s, and he said, we get 14 tapes out for Coach Tressel, and they go to all the assistants right away. And that's basically what we do right now. You know, we have a defensive coordinator, offensive coordinator. I give them, you know, great freedom, but they better, you know, do the job. You know, we better not turn the ball over. We better shoot the get great high percentage shots and defensively. And I'm in on all that, but I believe in giving your assistants, you know, great responsibility. You know, we have a big man coach that just, you know, worked with our big guys specifically. Luke Jacone, I make him come. He's back from college. Said, Luke, you're working with our guards all summer just on your ball handling drills and all that. So we try, you know, not to miss a beat, you know, and we get on the floor. We talked about, you know, not having any weaknesses as players and as a team. But technology really, really helps us out. And it's amazing. I hate to see what it is in the future. I don't know how it could get better.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine that the next iteration of what that's going to look like. I can't even imagine it. When you guys are in practice with you and your staff, how do you balance letting the practice flow versus identifying things that you want your players to correct or fix or go through and say, hey, here's a read that I think you missed, or here's a play where I think you should have done something differently? I know that's always something that coaches, I don't want to say struggle with, but they try to find that balance of you can't stop it on every little mistake and every little read that the player made incorrectly, but yet you still have to be coaching. So how do you think about that? How do you approach your, I guess, instructional time during practice?
You know, I very seldom like to stop play. We'll pull a player out that is making the mistakes or maybe doesn't understand and tell him to watch. And he'll be right near myself or a coach. And, you know, then we'll throw him back in and see if he gets it. And if he doesn't, you know, pull him out. I'll tell my assistants, don't stop it. Pull him out, you know, send somebody in. But, you know, we have to be in such great shape. And I believe that when we go into a game, if we aren't in much better shape, then we're not going to get those two runs a half because teams are going to be able to have the same energy level that we do. So in practice, we really try to just push them. And at the end, when they're dead tired, put 3-4 minutes down 10 that you really have to, you know, get that second, third, fourth effort. And, you know, mentality wise, when they see that they can do it, it really helps when they step on the floor. We'll address issues and problems at the beginning of a practice. You know, do walk through that. But once we start, we just go full go. I believe in Eat That Frog. Have you ever read that book, Mike?
Yes, yes.
The small one. It's big letters. It's a small book. But it's do the things that are most important and the toughest, like early in the day. So we do defensively, we do that at the beginning of every practice. Our presses defensively, it's almost like I believe that's the most strenuous, it's the toughest, it's the most important in our system because the presses and defense dictates our offense and, you know, our how many points we do score. So we really work on that and go right into the meat of our program really, really early. You know, I say make sure that you warm up. And when you tell me you're ready to go, we're ready to press, run, and we're going full go. So our players understand it. We don't practice, I'd say, 2 hours right on the nose. If we say 2:45, you better be there. I learned in the book, I put this, my very first year, I had a great player, just phenomenal captain. And it was a Friday night, probably the third week of November. And it was Saturday. We didn't have a scrimmage. I said, you know, we're going to practice 10 to 12 tomorrow. You know, be here ready to go. So he isn't there. And in those days, you know, it's no cell phones, whatever. So at 11:50, he walks in the gym. And I said, where were you? You know, we've been practicing. He said, Coach, you said 10 to 12. We were starting. So from that point on, you know, I know 10 o'clock. 2:12 o'clock, 10:30. It was a great learning experience for me to be so specific and clear and transparent. And it wasn't his fault. I wanted to kill him, but it was just a great learning experience in my first year.
That specific language is critical, right? And kids, they can be very literal. You learn that with players, and you certainly learn that with your own kids. That they will, they will take you very literally if given that opportunity. How do you incorporate shooting into your practices? Do you guys do a lot of shooting within your practice setting, or is that something that you have an expectation, or there's been an expectation set that players are getting shots up during the season before, after practice? Just how do you approach, clearly shooting is an important part of what you guys do. So you got the pressing that you're known for defensively, and then you're getting a lot of shots up. You want everybody on your team to be able to shoot three. So how do you approach shooting as a coach during the season?
Well, we really try to work on fundamentals form in the summer and in the off season. Very seldom we ever try to change, maybe tweak during the season. But we shoot at the end of practice, not for a long period of time. But my belief is you're much better off shooting when you're dead tired, because that's in sprinting. You know, I like the gun, but you get the perfect pass from the gun and you're just standing there waiting for it. So I think it's good fundamentally, but I prefer, you know, when you're tired. We even have a bad passing drill where, you know, they're moving, we're throwing the ball, you know, right, left, lower, higher, because that's what the passes you're going to get a lot of times, you know, during a game and in a season. So we try to work really when you're tired, and we shot chart, try to get the percentages, and so that we're always looking to improve. You know, if you're shooting 100 shots after a practice, and, you know, you're at 55, you know, in 2 weeks, you know, let's get you up to 60, two more weeks, 65% with nobody on you. We put up a drill, Nick Cochran, the very first season of the three. Nick was a leading three-point shooter in the state. He would put a chair with a broom on the right wing and the left wing, and he would just dribble two dribbles right and left and try to shoot over the broom, which is like similar to a hand in the face. And I love that. We'll still use that. We'll use the big ball. I tell them that every high school and college team that used the big ball consistently improved their free throw and their three-point shooting. We have about 7 big balls. They don't listen to me, but some of them, you know, if their shot's really bad, I'll see them get out of the big ball and I'll say, you're just trying to bust me, aren't you? But we do shoot a lot, I would say, on weekends and after practices. Luke Chacon was one of the best captains I've ever had. If we had a 2:45 to 5 practice, I'd say if we didn't play, Luke and about 2, 3, 4 guys would come in with an assistant coach 8:30 to 9:30 or 9 to 10 and just shoot. Now, there's a lot of camaraderie and, you know, BS at that time, but they're still getting off shots. And I even like the fact that they're bonding and they're building that relationships. That's one of the things when we talk about, like at the camp next week, we'll have, you know, 10, 11 stations, and I'll tell our players and our assistant coaches, every one of those kids better know everybody's name in their station, because this is about making relationships and about making great relationships. And I love the fact that in the summer we'll go away a couple, 2 nights, 3 nights, and that's when you really bond. When we won the state in 2013, a couple of newspapers did articles on our players, and they asked the best part. Well, naturally, it was a state tournament, but winning the state title. But a couple said, you know, the 3-4 night camps when it's 90, 95 degrees and you're playing 3 to 4 games and you're with your buddies. And I thought that was just unbelievable. And I really believe in, you know, that summer, building your relationships with your team players, and even building the relationships with the parents. You know, getting to know them, because they're there a lot of times at summer league games, they're driving, you know, they put so much time and effort in. So I believe we do have a family at Mentor. It's the parents, it's the families, it's the players, it's the assistants. And that's one thing I believed in right from the start.
All right, last question, two-parter. When you think about what it is that you have ahead of you in the next year or two, what do you see as being the biggest challenge? And then part two, what's your biggest joy? When you think about what you get to do every single day, what brings you the most joy in being the head boys basketball coach at Mentor High School? So your biggest challenge and then your biggest joy.
Biggest challenge is, well, let's go back to this year. We were 9-6 and we were struggling. And then we went on 11 game winning streak, won the league, went to the districts. I believe we had a 16-point lead on Eds. And I asked a couple of our players, when do we start believing in our team and when do we really start believing in ourselves? And Sean Collins, our captain, said the Solon game, coach, which we had to win the league title. And then, you know, we beat Brush and we win a couple really big games. But I knew we at one point, and I thought he was right on, but I wanted to hear his response. I knew that this past year, unless we believed in ourselves and believed in our teammates, we weren't going to do well. So the answer to the question is, once we believe in ourselves, and we have some really good players, and we'll play one or two seniors, and you know, we have the next couple of years should be really good. But we have to get to the point where we play a lot of great teams in June and go through a couple months of just working really hard and then get on the floor for some November scrimmages. And hopefully I'll be able to tell that we believe in ourselves as a team and they believe in themselves as an individual. Second part, what gives me great joy is that I'm blessed. I have a great life. And that I still dream big. I believe that we can win a state title. I wouldn't be coaching if I didn't. I've had so many things with the book coming out, doing a lot of media stuff, that it was great last night to go to McKinley with my team. We'll go to Toledo St. John's the weekend. But to get in the gym is just, it's special. It's special. You know, I talked on a couple of the podcasts about going to war, you know, with your team. That's why you go to practice. That's why you do the stuff in the summer. That I know that going into a gym and going into this weekend, when we step on a floor and we're going to war against Medina or Solon, when we play maybe St. Ignatius at the Rocket Mortgage, that what we've done in the past and we're ready for the future. So I think that when I get up, I think we're going to work hard enough and I love what the future holds.
All right, before we get out, great answer. Before we wrap up, tell people again about the book, where they can find it, and then share how people can reach out to you, whether you want to share email, social media, your website, whatever, that the best way for people to find out more about you and your program, and then tell them where they can find the book as well.
Okay, first I'm going to be transparent and make sure everybody understands, as far as technology in the United States, I'm at the bottom of the barrel. I have some great people, my son, my sister, and Kathy Lombardo, that take care of all that media stuff for me, which is phenomenal. The book is called Mental Toughness, the Game Changer. It's through Newman Springs, and the biggest outlets are Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Apple iTunes. A lot of smaller bookstores will carry it. I've done some book signings. We have one in Menor on June 16th. At Helicopter's Daughter, and I think Barnes & Noble's will do one. I have one in New York with Coach Tressel's ties, which would be really, really cool. But again, very blessed. The book would not have been written if it wasn't for Kathy Lombardo, because she asked me 10 straight years. My son Connor is the website business. He designed the cover. His business is, I think it's Good Wolf. Just phenomenal that what he's done. My son Cole helps me out. He played with the ABA, the Buckets. It's nice that he's close, and I have a place to go in Florida, my family in New York. So I didn't mean to ramble. I think I got all that in. I have a website. I think you could Google Bob Krasancic or Krasancic. My email is krasancic@mentorschools.org. I'm on Instagram, all the media outlets, and I don't even know my passwords. Thank God my family and Kathy does.
Hey, there's a lot to navigate.
Yes, there is. And I got to be truthful. I am so bad at that. I have to call them to find out what my password and username is. It is sad.
Well, you learn as you go along and you try to figure it out. And probably the best thing that any of us can do in areas where we are not experts is to delegate, right? That's what you do as a head basketball coach. You delegate and you give jobs to people who you know can do it better than what you can do. And so that's really what it's all about. Bob, cannot thank you enough for taking the time out of your schedule this morning to jump on with us. It's been a pleasure getting to know a little bit more about you, your program, learn about the book. Can't wait to read it. And to everyone out there, thanks for listening, and we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads podcast, presented by Head Start Basketball.